the Lukey and Dakota show or the Sunday boxing podcast, or hey, it's those guys talking boxing again.
Hey, it's them boys.
Them boys, right? Where do we start with one of the best fights we've seen all year or one of the strangest occurrences we've seen all year?
I'm down to start with the best fight because that's kind of what I was fixated on last night. If you want to start from the top of the card.
Let's start with that. So let's to set the stage. Ray Ford beats Otabek Klomatov. I think I said that right.
It's close. Klomatov, I think.
Klomatov. Okay. I never can get those names right. Just absolutely everything you want in a title fight. You got a little bit of controversy. You got a little bit of both guys hurting each other. Guys mixing and matching styles, adjusting throughout. Dakota, I've set the stage for a dramatic 12th round knockout. Why don't you guide the viewer and listener through what you saw?
It was just a beautiful back and forth fight, right? Like Otabek came out and I think had way better boxing skills than Ray was anticipating, and was actually doing a good job just kind of controlling the range and staying busy. And he found something in the fifth round pressuring Klomatov, and took a bunch of those middle rounds. And then it felt like Klomatov actually had sort of a resurgence between 9, 10, and 11. And I think regardless of how you saw it, right, it was a close fight because there were so many close rounds. I thought Klomatov was up going into that 12th round. And for Ford to get the stoppage when the facts were that he was going to lose a split decision if he got a knockdown, if he didn't, right, he needed a knockout or three knockdowns to not get a draw. You know, it was just a sensational ending. My initial reaction to the stoppage was a little just confused, but in seeing the replay, you know, Klomatov turned his back all the way and Ford was able to unload like a four-punch combination. I'm not sure what else the ref is supposed to do regardless of how much time there is. And then after all of the drama of the fight itself, we find out that Klomatov had, I believe, a torn ACL in the third round, which only adds to the drama of what was already an incredible fight that, you know, one of them was fighting with a very severe knee injury and still managed to fight an incredible fight.
And that was Lukey breaking news. I gave that to you last night. Broke that world-class news to you. But let's talk about the knockdown, because I think for some people that will be the story of the fight, because that sequence of events, it could have been a knockdown called prior. If that knockdown gets called, then probably Ford doesn't win because there wouldn't have been that much time. The slip, he gets hit with a shot. He turns his back. He goes to the corner. The fight is waved off, I believe, with 7 seconds. How did you feel about that sequence of events?
Again, you know, like I said, I initially thought it was a weird stoppage. Mostly just because I think there was a lot going on in a short period of time, right? Otabek was clearly hurt and Ford was in pursuit. And listen, we've seen this a couple of times, the Christina Cruz, Gabriela Fundora fight. You know, you just can't turn your back all the way. That's really the thing. You can't turn your back all the way and let a guy unload a couple of shots and expect that the referee is going to allow the fight to continue. So in retrospect, I really don't have any issue with the stoppage. I wouldn't have had an issue with a not stoppage either, but it's tough for me to argue against, you know, the guy turns his back all the way and the other guy's swinging. What, you know, it doesn't really matter how much time is left.
To me, he failed the body language exam. Like when you basically, he turned his back and ran from his opponent. I think if he had just pulled back onto the ropes, covered up and gotten hit with those shots, the fight wasn't over. I think the passive nature and the looking to get away from Ray Ford is what stopped this fight.
Yeah. And I think, I think he was legitimately hurt, right? I don't think anyone at that level makes the conscious effort to turn their back. Like, I really do think you lose control over yourself a little bit once you get clipped. And it's not so easy as, well, just turn around. Well, if you're struggling to figure out where your head, shoulders, knees, and toes are, it's not that simple.
And I think that we're also underplaying the kind of severity to this fight. there was a level of war to this fight, because it, I think that Ford, and you kind of brought this up, but I'm just rambling. I think he somewhat expected to be able to, like he said in the post fight, to land his jab, to be able to control range. And that was kind of thrown out the window very early. And he and Coach Anthony coached an amazing fight. They made an adjustment very early on that he needed to go forward and do something that no one expected. And I thought that that was interesting, because it essentially said what we might have thought we were going to do isn't going to work in this fight. And we have to be willing to do things that we're not comfortable doing.
Well, and how great of, I mean, you really got to have your as a coach, right? You got to have your ego in check, because I think a lot of coaches would be like, no, you're not doing it the way I want you to, as opposed to we need to switch our approach, you know, and it's okay to be flexible and adaptable in a difficult fight against a skilled fighter.
Yeah, that's I thought it was everything I tune into a prize fight for. I think that what it reminded me of a lot was James Toney versus Giroff, in a way.
Yep.
Because it was like, it kind of felt like a fight was going one way. And then at the very end, you asked me who I had winning, and probably Otabek was probably winning on points. But from the ninth round on, I saw Ray Ford clearly doing the better work, clearly the guy that you'd rather be in the fight. And to me, I felt like he had the leg up, even though maybe on points he didn't. That 12th round kind of encapsulated what I was seeing. Not to say I'm genius boxing guy, but I did see a tide shift and him start to make Otabek question things about himself that I don't think he had ever had to.
Totally. And I think that's kind of what was special about the performance. I think maybe the difference between what I saw and what you saw is I think that actually some of the work that Kolmatov would do in those lapses, right, where Ray kind of doesn't let his hands go. He has little gaps where the offense kind of goes quiet for a minute. And I thought that the work that Kolmatov was doing in those gaps was actually super effective. You know, and I'm a big Tim Bradley fan. I felt like he couldn't really watch the fight. He just liked Ray Ford so much that even when it was like, you know, four rounds of pop, he was like, Ray Ford's dominating this fight. It's like, Tim, come on, bro. But so I think that kind of shaped a little, not for you. I'm just saying it shaped some of the narrative of the fight.
Be real. It could have. Like, it could have. Like, I'm not above being shaped by a narrative, by a commentator. Every now and then I typically don't watch these fights with the broadcast on. I think I had it off for about 7 rounds, but I jumped in round 8 with the broadcast on. I could have possibly
first 4 where Kolmatov was winning the rounds, all Bradley could talk about was Ray Ford and how, wow, incredible that he's stepping to this guy. And he was, right? But if you're not letting your hands go, again, if somebody isn't letting their hands go and one guy throws a couple punches and misses wide, I give it to the guy who had successful defense. If a guy gets to hit you 5 times on the gloves and on the arms and on the shoulders, it's not the same as a clean punch, but if you don't throw anything back, I got to give the guy the sequence, right?
I think what I would compare it to would be my beloved Sacramento Kings in basketball. We had a player named Brad Miller. He's a center. He'd shoot a 3-point. Yeah, you love Brad Miller. So he was a center. He'd shoot a 3-pointer. And people go, whoa, he's a center. He shoots a 3-pointer.
One of the first,
right? But we didn't win a ton of games. So it was really fun. It's like, whoa, the center's out there. He's going to take a 3. But we didn't go to the playoffs. And to me, that's what I was seeing with that was you can focus on, whoa, this is really cool. But I think there also in that conversation has to be a level of how effective is this at this given moment.
Right. And also, I think we have to talk about how effective I think Kolmatov's body work was. I mean, he was landing a lot of hard body shots, man. And I totally agree that the more eye-catching and damaging shots throughout the fight were landed by Ford. But I think that's what made it a close fight. It was a quality versus quantity type of fight.
Okay. If you were a gambling man, do you think we get a fight that is better than this in this month of March?
Well, fortunately for me, I'm not a gambling man. But if I was, you're going to have to do something really special to top this. I mean, already between this and then on the Berlanga card, having Rivera and Dominguez followed by Vargas and Rodriguez, like just in the last 2 weeks, we've had a couple of like sensational fights.
Yeah, and it's a shame, right? Because I feel like most of the time with awards or discussions around fights, people want the big name fighters. And sometimes right. The best fights come from guys that are very hungry that want you to call them a big name fighter. And I think another story to this fight, what made the fight so great was Ray Ford and Otabek wanted to be greatness. You know, you saw Ray Ford coming out to the song that Gervonta came out to. It wasn't Gervonta, but it's one of those Chicago rap songs, and it's in that genre, and you could see it mattered to him. I saw Otabek come out to Eminem. Like, it was like you could see that they've been inspired by pay-per-view fighters. You know, that's the Crawford song. It felt like they were very much like, how do I arrive at this moment? And they both didn't want to fade. And that's what creates special moments. Sometimes in main event fighters and fighters with big names or not as big of names, it's easier to be like, well, I'm rich, or well, I got to this point. And I think what made this fight so special was neither guy was content to just be there.
Mm-mm. Nah, man, they both wanted to walk away with something meaningful. You know, you don't fight like that unless that's what you're looking for.
Hot take. I'm not sure Otabek ever is the same again. Like, I can't, like, maybe, but like, typically when guys lose these type of fights, it has an effect on the career. I'm not saying he won't win a world title, but I'm just saying I think this fight is going to be something we look back on and say, man, that Ray Ford fight was a turning point in his career. Also, Ray Ford did the thing that I don't absolutely love, and you and me agree, wins a world title and says, oh, by the way, I'm not going to fight at this belt. No. Kind of weird, if we're going to be honest, kind of weird. So the belt is basically vacant again.
It's informally vacant, right? I mean, we don't know for sure. Again, we always talk about this. It's tough when you stick a mic in a guy's face right after the fight where he's just like, I'm never making that weight again in my life. But you put the right contract in front of him, maybe that changes, right? So we'll have to see how that actually plays out. I'll take a man at his word, though.
I mean, I just think that fighter interviews, especially in the modern era, are getting more and more cringy.
Well, and this was right. His was mild. If that was the worst thing he said, I thought he came off as a very likable, intelligent champion.
And given what we've been having to deal with for the past month from press conferences and fighters in the ring,
yeah,
this was very normal and very blue collar. I'm a boxer. Almost like too honest. There was a level of like, you could tell he hasn't been at this level too much because he just kind of shared with the public probably something he probably should have kept to his chest.
But think about this. If you're comparing him right to Ryan Garcia, he's younger than Ryan Garcia. He just won a world title, so he got to something that Ryan Garcia hasn't been able to get to faster than he was able to get to it, and handled the moment in a much, I would say, classier fashion.
I also think there's something to be said for adversity. Like, people that face adversity, whether right or wrong, in their childhood are forced to grow up and forced to mature in a way where they don't want to be defined by their past. We've seen this with guys like Bernard Hopkins, with my friend Quentin Randall. We see it with Ray Ford. A lot of these guys, right? Guys like Ryan Garcia, guys like Teofimo Lopez are kind of going through those moments in their 20s because they didn't experience that same adversity. And part of that's a good thing, right? Parents being protective and not allowing. But that adversity, yep, I think, is kind of what also makes a mature individual. Like,
I don't think any of the older fighters that you just referenced understood being this type of famous as a teenager. So there's a lack of relatability on that side as well, I would say.
And I think also a lot of the older fighters don't understand why you would be famous if you didn't accomplish something.
Right. Well, and there's tons of the most famous people haven't really accomplished much of anything, right? So if again, this was always my concern and we'll get into this later on, but this was always my concern with like
celebrity. let's get into it because we're transitioning perfectly, and we'll weave or back and forth, because this is perfect.
The point that I've always made about this celebrity boxing is not, and the point is never that it can exist because I don't like it. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is there's always going to be people who are more famous than top level boxers. Does that mean that they get to come in and make more money than those guys exclusively because they bring more eyes to the table? Exclusively because more people would buy Oprah Winfrey versus Martha Stewart than they would buy Ray Ford versus Kolmatov, right? Does that mean that they get to come into our sport and dictate the terms? And that's always been my issue with it.
So on Instagram, I posted a video from our once a week podcast that you and me occasionally do on my Substack. Sometimes it's me, sometimes Dakota comes on to answer some questions. We got questions already, so I'll save them up for when we have time. We both did a rant about Ryan Garcia. Without including the name, a few people thought that we were talking about Jake Paul. And I thought that was interesting because Jake Paul and Ryan Garcia, though Ryan's a pro boxer who's gone boxing career, there's a lot of similarities to when you talk about both guys, you can say the same criticism. And I thought that was just an interesting thing that Ryan Garcia is in a position where Jake Paul and him are closer to peers than they're not.
And the sands have really shifted on that, right? Like not terribly long ago, I was of the opinion that the criticism of Ryan Garcia was basically unfair, that it's not his fault that he's a good looking kid and he's famous and he's willing to take tough fights, all of which I still believe. I just think that how he's conducting himself as a man publicly, I don't respect. And the irony of when Jake Paul first came into the game and he was known as like a YouTube prankster who would like harass working class people on the street. When he came into boxing, he kind of carried some of that character with him. And as he's become more of a fighter and learned to respect the sport more, I find him much less cringy than I find Ryan Garcia. So it's just funny how those things change over time.
Well, I think the thing with Jake Paul is he has a level of likability because you see a growth in him and you actually see him wanting to adopt the culture he's jumping into. Like, I feel like he's really trying to be like, no, I'm a boxer. I'm going to do the boxing thing. And I think that with guys like Ryan Garcia, there's a lack of self-awareness to do that. And I think that Jake is getting some goodwill because, like, he's kind of doing the thing boxing fans ask of some of these cringy fighters.
Well, and just the morsel of self-awareness that you're talking about, I think is bringing Jake Paul a long way forward, just in the fact that like something as simple as, you know, allowing the main event spot to Amanda Serrano, because why would Amanda Serrano be on my undercard? You know, that little bit of self-awareness goes a long way with boxing fans. It went a long way with me and it's not for me, you know?
That's true. I want to get a cup of coffee. So what do you want to focus on of this Paul thing? Do you want to talk Amanda Serrano? Do you want to talk Ryan Borland, Jake Paul? Which of those, because it's going to take me about a minute to pour a cup of coffee. What do you want to do a Dakota rant on?
I'm going to do a Dakota rant about Troy Isley. So
okay, we're going to switch over to Troy Isley. Okay.
If we're doing a coffee
break, do a Dakota rant. We're going to, so let me just set the time cue and do a Dakota rant on Troy Isley. I like that because Troy deserves a Dakota rant.
I honestly think Troy might have been the fighter of the night for me. I mean, there was just a lot of great performances, but, you know, having watched Troy develop over the last couple of fights, really over his whole career, right? He was one of those pandemic fighters that we got to watch sort of from the ground up. And it's been a pleasure to watch him, but he has had difficult fights. He's taken tough competition. And I think as a result of not just taking easy fights against fighters that he can just walk through, maybe the public hasn't caught on to him as much because they don't see a dominant fighter, but what they're not understanding is that he is actually legitimately taking fights that he could lose, which a lot of young guys in his position don't do. And Marcos Hernandez has been around a long time, tough guy. And Troy just looked like he really found himself offensively, and his confidence, you know, fighting somebody like Vladimir Hernandez, who's such a tough, rugged, physical guy. You know, you get through a fight like that, it's like other fights aren't as concerning once you've been through a fight like that. Once you've been through the fight with Victor Toney, where the guy's really smart and defensive, and he's just seen more things, more styles, more challenges than a lot of young fighters in his position at the moment. And it culminated in a stoppage. He just stays loose. His offense is real loose. That's what I like about him. The fluidity of his offense. I never feel like he's looking for the perfect shot. He's just making it happen. He's going to let his hands go in combination. And he's really hard to hit. So I just think he's kind of he's starting to become the total package as far as prospects go. And I think that particularly after these last two, he's starting to move himself into contender status. And especially with middleweight, you know, we talk about middleweight on this channel all the time and on my channel, but you know, middleweight's a division that's searching for an identity and searching for a guy. And I don't see any reason why Troy Isley is not ready to get thrown into that mix, you know? Perfect timing.
That's great. That was a great rant. I'm going to pretend like I listened to the whole thing. I poured a good cup of coffee, but here's my thing. Troy, I've never seen him look sharper, faster. He fought a good friend of mine, Marcos Fernandez. I really like Troy. I've always thought he was a really good, I thought he was one of the most pro-ready amateurs to pro. The fluidity was something I've never seen with Troy. It really felt like against a very, very good fighter in Marky Hernandez, he had his best performance. And he deserves to be mentioned with the Abdullah Masons, with the Bruce Carringtons. He's now at that level, in my opinion, as a standout, noteworthy fighter.
There's a part of me that feels like he's farther ahead because he's fighting guys who are legitimately like fringe contenders at this point. I mean, Vladimir Hernandez is the toughest.
He's a contender, bro. To me, he's a contender because this is a shallow division, and he beat two guys who have given guys issues in the past. I don't give a poo-poo about their record. He beat two credible guys, and, you know, he's not that far away from Janny Beck.
No, and I think those are that's the thing, right? And that was part of my rant, but we've talked about middleweight. It's like there are some exciting middleweights, but the idea that any of them might fight each other is so foreign that I think we forget about the division because it's like, no, why would fucking, you know, Janny Beck and Carlos Adames fight each other? You know, that any of those fights for whatever reason are like impossible for all of our brains to conceive of. But I think Troy could be one of those guys in this weight class. Like, put him in with Ian Green. Put him in with Joe Sean James. Put him in with Carlos Adames. I'm ready for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's exciting. So, other notes from this undercard. Luis Alberto Lopez, absolutely a star. You hit it right. Why don't you go on? There's something about him where the casual fan is going to just be endeared to him because nothing about what he does seems like it should work. It almost looks comical, and he's just beating guys up, and he has a level of arrogance about the way he comes forward and sticks his chin out, but then he moves his head a lot. I think it's very approachable and very relatable to a fan because you just see this guy who's awkward, who's able to beat guys up, and it's, for lack of a better word, entertaining.
Yeah, bro, he's just throwing punches from angles where a normal person wouldn't really be able to maximize their power, or you just wouldn't get taught to set shots up that way. There's a lot of looping shots with his hands down. But the truth is, the only time you can really get him is while he's punching. If you just throw punches at him on the outside, he's very slick. He moves his head. He keeps it nice and loose. I never feel like, same with how Troy fought, I never feel like he gets caught looking for too long. Like, he's just a make something happen kind of guy. As much as I love Ray and Odebeck, it was like, this is a main event fighter right here. This is the guy in this weight class. I don't know how this isn't the main event.
And I kind of got that sense too, was this is like, I think Luis Alberto Lopez is a star. I think he's a main event fighter. And I think that he's, when he fights, crowds are gravitating to him.
Yeah. I mean, he literally like interacted with the crowd and then moments later stopped the fight. Like it kind of checks all the boxes. So I guess I don't understand the, I guess sort of the lack of institutional backing.
Well, I think he wasn't supposed to be this, right? He had multiple losses.
So far past that, bro. I mean, we're like 19 wins in a row. At what point is he just the guy?
I don't know. Lionel Watson says, Luis Alberto's run is ending. His aggressive style is catching up with him, in my opinion. And then he said, maybe not. The guy that's going
to... What about this fight would have indicated that to you?
I mean, to me, what I thought was special was what you said. He looked bored in there from beating a guy up and the guy's eye swelling. The crowd says his name. He tells them, cheer him on, and gets a stoppage within 15 seconds. I mean, that alone.
How do you do it, bro?
But he literally hulks up, tells the crowd like a pro wrestler, come on, cheer me on. And then he just recklessly throws a 15-punch combination where the fighter wasn't throwing back. And the referee just said, man, this just isn't fair. Like, you can't do this to this poor guy.
And by the way, a big shout out to Abe, who had that hematoma on his eye starting from the second or third round and made it, I believe, to the eighth or the ninth round and was throwing back the entire time. I mean, this was not a schlub that Lopez did this to. This was a skilled guy who wanted to be there, and he made it look easy.
And a stylistic nightmare. Like, he had elements of Ruben Villa, and Ruben had beaten him. Southpaw, tricky, mover, and...
Not that easy to hit either, right? Like, for a normal guy, like, I don't see him as, like, a bad defensive fighter, but when a guy steps inside the southpaw front foot and throws a looping right hand that normally wouldn't have power on it, but for whatever reason hurts... You know, it's just,
I think another issue is Aiba had no sense of what to do when he wasn't at full distance. So it was like, OK, we got to get out of Dodge. And then when Lopez found out, oh, when I'm in the mid range or I'm in close, this guy's only defense is hold and I'm stronger than him. He felt very, very comfortable at what was going to be going on because he knew the most dangerous place he could be was going to be on the outside. So it felt like he wanted that pressure. He wanted to get inside that full extension range. And then once he was there, it was just, let's relentlessly attack.
Yep. And it worked, bro. He's very effective at what he does, and you can't teach what he does.
Not at all. And I almost feel like if you tried to teach what he did, that would just be neglectful.
And people would like fall and trip over their feet and look stupid, you know, like he's doing some wild shit. You're not supposed to leap halfway across the ring, but.
So the modern Mexican legends, in my opinion, we obviously have Canelo. I would put Juan Francisco Estrada there. Who's the Emmanuel Navarrete? And then I think it's Luis Alberto Lopez. Would you say he's right now the fourth most accomplished Mexican fighter?
You got to have him in there. I mean, if you're doing also Mexican-Americans, I would put Bam in there. But yeah, I think those are the big four.
But I mean, like, isn't like the thing about like, oh, Mexican fighters, they're going to sell. There's a whole country behind him. But this guy seems to be like he defies every reason. Like, he doesn't quite get the main event spots. He's so proud to be a Mexican fighter. He's the underdog. And yet, he's not quite getting the Emmanuel Navarrete push yet. He's not getting I don't know. I just think his story is so interesting because he's the guy that's supposed to be used and abused by boxing. He was supposed to be the cannon fodder for all these great fighters. And he just went in there and beat everybody. Like, to me, it proves he can really fight. Like, there's no manufacturing in his resume.
No, the politics of boxing have yet to get up behind him. And, I think when somebody's this successful without that, it's really impressive.
To me, him and Shock Foster are two of the most accomplished fighters because they've never really had the system working for them.
Yeah, and still don't, right? They're doing it and they still don't. I think some of that too is it's like, I don't know if it's like a guy like Lopez, you know, if I can't speak for anyone at Top Rank, but if it's just like you fucked up so many of our plans, kind of, you know.
I think he's just awkward. Because I've done an interview with his manager, and like he said something that always stuck out to me. He was like, "Batman needs the Joker." And like he kind of referred to Venado Lopez as like the Joker. Like they kind of view him as the villain, like a villain figure, but he doesn't portray himself as a villain. But like I think they think of themselves as, we like going into another person's place and ruining everything. How do you market that as like, I'm the guy that spoils your birthday party? I think that that's part of the issue, is what he really likes doing and what he's most successful at is, he's the guy that's not promoted. He's the guy that has a chip on his shoulder. And his worst performance of recent was when he main evented against Joette Gonzalez. His best performances have been when he's the underdog or where he's in the co-main event spot with a chip on his shoulder.
Right. And again, I just give the credit to Joette for always showing up on that one, to be honest.
I think you and me are probably the most rational boxing fans when it comes to Joette, because we both view him as a world-class guy. Who,
when's he not showed up, dude? You know, when did the kid not show up?
And shout out afternoon guys, Bipolar Boxing. Thank you. You could have picked any boxing podcast, but you're here with us and we appreciate it.
Love that.
I'm trying to think else. Janelson Boca Chica Figueroa against Brian Norman Jr. Really awkward fight. What did you think of that one?
I don't even really know what to think of that. There's just certain matchups and there's certain guys. Like, I just think Brian Norman he's a tough out and he's also a tough watch, bro. Like, it's kind of ugly. It doesn't really have an identity. And now we're just having like multiple strange fights. He threw an elbow on the inside that kind of opened up a cut. I just think that it's an odd fight, you know. It's an odd fight, and he's kind of an odd fighter, and I'm not really sure how to interpret him.
Well, we've got two case studies for who I think Brian Norman fights like, and that's either my friend Kareem Mayfield or Sean Porter. And I think he could go one of two ways, but I view him as kind of a mauler, a come forward aggressive guy by any means. I think he's very physically strong. I think he does have power. But as he goes higher up in the levels, I think the strategy component is where he gets in trouble, because what I was seeing with Figueroa Boca Chica was throwing straight punches. He had good timing. He had a little wiggle to him, and he was able to time Norman, in my opinion, because Norman's extremely tense and he throws at one speed. And then because he throws at one speed, like you said, his identity then starts to have issues because he's doing one thing. So it's like, maybe if I stay on the outside and I charge up like Sonic the Hedgehog, then I'll catch him off guard. Or maybe I'll come in and I'll throw a jab, but my head's going to be on the center line a little bit. And it's like he's looking. And I think there's also like something incredible about that, because it's showing that like he's able to adjust based on his unique pattern. But we've seen two different career paths with that style. We've seen Sean Porter and we've seen Kareem Mayfield, and they had two different things. But to me, when I look at Brian Norman right now, I think that's the trajectory he is on.
He's not entertaining the way Kareem was, even. You know, it's like a tough watch.
Well, I think Kareem at times got labeled as not entertaining, but I think that that was also not true. Like, I think Kareem was wildly entertaining because he was always looking for a big right hand and he was trying to make a fight. And even when like the fight was like a clinch, he was working. I think what was weird about this fight was how so many cuts occurred so fast. Like that, it's like, okay, the Norman fight, Norman and Randall was an awful fight. And that fight happened in the sense that like both guys just kind of ran into each other. They just kind of kept running into each other and there wasn't a lot happening. This one, they were running into each other and the heads kept banging in.
I mean, it shows to me he doesn't understand his own distance, which I think is a very basic sort of thing you want to establish as a young fighter. Like, what is my style? What is the best distance for me to throw at? And last fight against Quentin, we see him kind of just run in and smother his own work every single time. And then in this one, we see that he can't keep the separation and just winds up fouling guys and the fight gets called early. And, you know, I just think that they have just some things they need to rethink. Because as a fan, it's not a great watch.
I think that part of it too is he's very front foot heavy. So like he's really trying to land a right hand or a left hook. And that when you're really front foot heavy, you're going to fall forward.
Yeah. Which he does. Right. I mean, that's his whole offense, unfortunately.
Because like, I think that part of that is he's trying to put everything on every shot. He falls forward. He gets dropped at the end of the first round because Boca Chica knew that he's throwing the fastball from third base to first. And he throws a straight punch and basically uses his momentum to knock him down because he beat him to the punch.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly what happened.
What did you think of the Boca Chica Figueroa's corner stopping the fight in the third round so it wouldn't go to scorecards, it felt like?
That's a personal call on their end. I mean, that cut on his hairline was really bad, and he had two cuts over his eye. I don't know. It started to feel like excessive.
No, I get it. I just was a little shocked because I felt like he was probably up at that point. Like he had a knockdown and I thought he probably had won a round.
Right.
So I was kind of surprised they didn't go to the fourth round because it felt like they probably would have eked out a 4-round decision.
I mean, there may not have even been that much thought put into it where it's just like, listen, I don't know if our guy can go. We got to call it, not necessarily thinking about what round number it is, which would be a mistake on their part, but I think that they were just looking after their guy.
You know what, though? You say it was a mistake, but I think I'd respect that more than the way I was thinking. Is if you just look at the moment as an individual and say, how healthy is my fighter at this moment? F the circumstance. Maybe it's just not right to do it. I think I respect that a ton if that really was the logic that went into it.
That's how I interpreted it. And by the way, he's a hell of a fighter. And I know that there's been some mixed results for him the last couple of fights, but he's good and he's young, you know.
Let's get to the chat. Just people saying positive things. Always great to hear Luki and Dakota take on boxing. Enjoyed the Ford fight. We love you, Martin Mulligan. Bipolar Boxing. I was at the fights last night. Lost my voice after the Ford fight. Bipolar Boxing, we're so glad you got to return to Verona, New York, and what a great fight to usher you back to a place you went to boxing.
What a great card.
What a way to go back. He said, oh, I moved back, all this. They welcome him back with a fantastic card. Hopefully, maybe the Hall of Fame, they do a card up there and you get another banger. I'm trying to think other good fights on this undercard. We had Bryce Mills. I thought that was a fantastic fight. Two of the judges didn't even watch the fight. They gave the other Bryce all the rounds, which I think is unfair because the guy he fought his butt off. It was a fun. I think that there should be like 6-round regional fights on some of these big ones because the New York fight with the Boston guys, where there's a little bad blood and they're fighting on Top Rank ESPN and they're so excited. I think that there's just like a lot of fun to those fights, you know, get a good little 6-rounder that behaves like a title fight on these cards. Did you get that vibe from that fight where
it's like, I want the for all the marbles of Verona, New York, or like, you know, for all the marbles in Shenango County or whatever the fuck.
Well, I think that this harkens back to something we've gotten away from. There should be state titles. And maybe on these big telecasts, we should have the New York State title contested in a 6-round fight.
They do it in Europe, right? They do it in the UK. All of those regional belts actually mean something out there. Why don't we have, why do people look at the NABO as like, who gives a shit? Well, it's because the sanctioning bodies don't treat them the same way that they do in Europe.
But I think that, a matchup like this, and I know there was a belt of some sort on the line, but this is why I tune in for boxing is like, these were two guys who have to work a job probably who were really thrilled to fight on ESPN. And it might be one of the best moments of their life. And they both tried to win and they both fought a great fight. And I think that there's a place for that. Is it world-class boxing? I'm not sure, but there's a level to that makes you want to watch that. At least for me, I enjoy watching maybe a tier below world class if it's even and it means the world to them.
Yeah, totally. Because in their world, the stakes were super high.
And for all the people that might say, oh, why are you saying tier below? As of right now, they both could go on to be world-class fighters. I think that it's very difficult at the stage they're both at to be labeled a world-class fighter that early on in your career. I mean, Bryce, I think, has 15 fights or 16 fights, but he only had like 15 amateur fights. So he's very early in his career. Any other notable ones we should talk about from this undercard?
I think we basically covered all that needs to be.
I had some notes, so because I was on coverage for Boxing Scene, so I did all the undercard reporting. So people can go there and stuff. Floyd Diaz coming to the arena late and getting fined. I put that in the cautionary zone, like cautionary tale, little concerning. When you can't get to the arena on time, working with BOMAC, not his dad, not in the corner, some changes. I noticed that. So that's just filed away as just an interesting observation. Nico Ollie Walsh, second fight of the night. I think that benefits Nico. I think that he's a guy that's had a lot of TV exposure. And if he can fight a little lower on the card and just get rounds in and gain experience, I think that's actually better for him in terms of his development.
Honestly, and we talked about this, I thought that this was probably the best he looked, even if it was like 4-2 or 3-3 kind of fight. I thought that this was the best he looked. I thought he looked the most relaxed. I thought his skills are starting to come together a little bit. So it's all just a part of the development. But I do think that he's actually doing the developing.
Yeah, so our good friend Gail of New York Fights, Gail, I would say your last name, but everyone knows Lukey says names all wrong. And then you'll come up to me and go, it's okay. Because Gail's the nicest person ever. She'll be super kind and be like, it's okay, Lukey. And then she'll kindly correct me as opposed to being mean about it and correcting me. She'll be like, yeah, this is how you. So Gail, NY Fights, someone that I actually deeply look up to because she's extremely professional and she's one of the kindest people I've ever met in boxing. And boxing is not a sport where you typically meet very kind people. And basically, if you can support Gail, that would really mean a lot to all. We should probably get Gail on for one of these shows because she's really awesome. And I think more people, not that our show is like vibrant and like going to give people massive opportunities, but I think that that might be cool to have like some people like that. But what did you think of because I broke the news to you via text.
Yes, you did. Thank you.
Did you like that? Did you like that real-time journalism?
Yeah, it was great. Well, and I'm just going to be brutally honest. I wasn't watching that card. So I had no awareness that anything out of the ordinary was happening.
Let me set the stage as far as what I know as of now. I've done no reporting or research or reading this morning. So this is just what I know, okay? So this is just the facts, Jack, even though you're Dakota. I get a text message. Then I get 12 text messages. I think, oh my God, what did I do wrong? Because when you get 12 text messages in 3 minutes, typically it's a, I just did something wrong. And people that either want to hate on me or care about me are saying, you need to take this down, or you're the biggest idiot, I'm gonna kick your butt. That typically is like what you get. 12 text messages. All about what's going on with Amanda Serrano. And I'm like, huh? I have no connection to Amanda. Like, my first thought was, I don't know Amanda Serrano. I once was in New York maybe 8 years ago, and I was going to try to maybe do a video with her and Heather Hardy. It fell apart, and there was no way to do it. And Gail said that she'll come on the show anytime. So when we find the right, really average card, Gail, we will bring you on, because that's just how we do our guests. We find those real mid-tier cards to bring our guests on. We no, we'll bring you on for maybe the Tim Zhu, Keith Thurman. We need some star firepower.
We'll bring you on for the hot new single.
We'll bring you on for the hot new segment, you know. let's bring you on for when they go to Tulsa, Oklahoma and have a bunch of 8-rounders on TV. We'll bring you on for that card and make you go through the undercard with us. So I have no connection to Amanda Serrano. I don't really have a connection to MVP. Then my next thought was, I've known Ryan Borland for maybe 12 years. People assume maybe I know the promoter, because like the B-side guy is. So I'm just in my head, I'm thinking, why are people asking about Amanda Serrano? Because it's like, I don't know. And then I go and start Googling, and there's something about, so I don't want to be misquoted here, but there was something about an eye. Something happened with her eye. Now the timeline is confusing. Lance Pugmire on Boxing Scene, I believe, has an article about the timeline, which I encourage people reading because I think he did excellent research. I haven't gotten a chance to read it yet because I did like 10 hours of boxing coverage yesterday, live coverage. So I'm a little bit not trying to read right now. My eyes are like going all crazy. Back to the story. So there's a lot of rumors going around that Amanda's not going to fight. And then for me personally, and I know you're not a big press conference and weigh-in guy, but I do the press conferences and weigh-ins. When this happened, I couldn't help but think about something that was weird to me. Amanda Serrano didn't do a face-off with Nina. And it struck me as weird. And I don't know what it was about that, but that kind of was like, I wonder why. Whenever these situations happen, every tiny thing gets examined. So Paul fights my guy Rhino, stops him in one round, and then it's announced to the crowd that Amanda Serrano would not be fighting. It was not brought up on a telecast nor via press release until Amanda was set to walk. That's the stage setter for this situation. Dakota, let's go from there.
It is odd. The only thing that makes sense to me is that it was a fight that she was trying to make happen up until the final minute and had to have a physician tell her that that wasn't an option, which I think to the audience might come off as unprofessional, but she may have been viewing it as, no, this is the most professional thing I can do is make sure I go and entertain the fans. And it didn't work out that way. And I think that the gesture of wanting to refund the audience will go a long way.
Well, I think, say what you want, Jake Paul is very good at business. And whenever he does things, he doesn't take the tactic of most boxing businesses, which is loot the store and run. There's always a level of how do we get goodwill back with the consumer. So I think that was a good thing. It's just, for me, it felt very state run when you don't announce that, okay, even saying there might be a situation. I mean, the opponent said that she found out right before she was going to walk, essentially, via a statement I got. I mean, it feels very state run. Like, if Nina had this issue, would this be announced the morning of? Like, I get that they want to fill people into this massive sporting stadium, but if we're a real sporting organization, like the NBA would tell you if LeBron James is not fighting or performing in the NBA. So we're starting to walk, like, not that boxing isn't the circus, but we're walking a circus line right here.
I mean, it's already a circus. I don't know that I agree that this fits into that category. I mean, I do wish that they had a little more self-awareness to say, like, yeah, I don't think that you are going to be able to perform with that eye. And like I said, you know, waiting for that long is always going to come off to the audience like it's not well thought out. I just think that not competing wasn't an option to her, and somebody else had to step in and say, no, this is not going to happen.
And also,
I do wish they tell us what happened to the eye too. You know, I wish they'd say, oh, you know, the drywall in the hotel was fucked up and something flew into my eye, or, you know, I got a bee sting. I got, you know, whatever it is, just kind of tell us.
I think the fact that it wasn't explained was strange. And the other thing is, this now becomes an ongoing storyline, the eye of Amanda Serrano. Because if we're going to be real, I don't think she has that many fights left in her career. So,
I mean, 50 in, bro. How many, you know, it's like.
I mean, I think that she has one or two maybe left in her. And the two would probably be Katie Taylor, the rematch, when they're both kind of done. So, I mean, to me, this really makes me wonder how much Amanda has left, because this is, it sounds like this is a fairly serious injury.
It would have to be if it prevented the fight from happening, right? Like if you got some lemon juice in your eye, that's not going to stop you from doing a title fight. So what was the thing that made it not feasible?
Do you want me to read the statement? I'm going to read the statement.
Read the statement.
I'm going to read the statement. Cover for me for a second because I'm going to, let's see. Let's see if I still have it.
Are you talking about the MVP statement?
Yeah, I'm going to read it, you know. Okay, here we go. Amanda has unfortunately been declared medically unfit by the Puerto Rican Boxing Commission to fight tonight due to an eye injury she sustained yesterday. She is devastated that she won't be able to perform in front of her hometown fans, but besides wanting to go and put on a show, the commission said there's no way she can fight with her eye in its current condition. The decision equally affects Nina Minkinoff, and MVP will pay paying her her fight purse in full. MVP and Amanda would like to apologize to everyone in attendance, and the company will provide full refunds for those seeking it. Details to follow on the refund process. Amanda is proud of the way her fellow MVP teammates competed on the night.
There you have it.
It's just a little weird. Like, that came out right after Paul won his fight.
The whole thing is weird, brother. It's hard for me to imagine any other scenario other than, like, they just weren't going to not get in the ring that night.
Yeah, it's just a weird situation. Real quickly, Jake Paul stops my friend Ryan Borland. Your thoughts?
Gotta see somebody your size that's a boxer, bro. Gotta see somebody your own size. That's all it is for me, man. If not, I'm giving you the respect of calling you a boxer. I gotta see somebody your size, bro. I gotta see somebody your size that's an active pro.
I mean, it's pretty, like, I mean, look, Jake hits hard and he's a lot bigger than Rhino, but Rhino knew what he was getting in for. He's getting overpaid to get an opportunity, and he had never gotten a fight like this. And for a lot of guys at the club level, like, to go through the motions of one of these big time fights is a big deal. Didn't work out the way he wanted, but he got to go through the motions of a big fight. And I think realistically, everyone wants to be a world champion, but realistically that isn't possible because there's not a number of belts. So I think the positive to this fight was Ryan got to go through the motions and get a fight that kind of will be remembered. When you fight Jake Paul, you got to remember that you're always going to be at a disadvantage. If you're coming in on his promotion, you're going to be smaller. You're going to be giving up because he's very good at figuring out systems, and he's going to have as many advantages as he can.
Well, and he has a whole different bar set for him than any other fighter. There's no other actual boxer that would be treated credibly with the opponent lineup that he has.
Yeah, and I mean, I keep saying it, he will be a world champion because there will be a sanctioning body that will strip a champion or vacate a belt, and they're going to give him a favorable matchup for a vacant world title. And then my buddy called me last night and goes, well, then he'll have to fight real fighters. He's going to be the highest paid cruiserweight. So do you think the sanctioning bodies are going to be like, oh man, we got to enforce him against this really tough game competitor? Or are there other guys that are blown up light heavyweights that we can have fight Jake Paul, who can make five times the amount of the purses we'd make with other cruiserweights? I mean, that's kind of like this. He's found a division that makes zero money, that is very vulnerable, that he can kind of overtake and own.
But also, by the way, that has many active fighters, none of which he's fighting. That's really my issue with it, is there are cruiserweights that exist. We don't have to just find super middleweights and light heavyweights that haven't fought in 6 years and make them gain 30 pounds.
And that's a fair criticism. And I think that he's done a good job at responding to criticism, but this is what he has to respond to now.
Well, and it's also easier to respond to criticism when your initial fan base is not boxing people. because they don't know what they're watching. They think he could beat Muhammad Ali, so it doesn't matter to them.
Well, and I think that they're marketing him and matching him so he has the aura of an early Mike Tyson. Because this is what Tyson was doing to world-class opposition. And I think there's a viral nature of let's get guys who are at a disadvantage but have good records on paper or notable personalities and get first or second round stoppages to really build this momentum. And I will give him credit that he's fighting very often. He fought in December. He's fighting in March. He's probably going to be back. Like, he's staying more active than pro boxers, albeit his opposition isn't the same. But I mean, the one thing he's doing right is he's not sitting on the shelf.
Right. I'm just making the point, like, you know, if Jaio Batalha took on somebody who'd never fought above light heavyweight, you know, and beat up on him, everyone would look down at him, and rightfully so.
Well, and I guess for me, I look at him as a science project. And that's
the thing with his fans is it's like, is he a real fighter or not? Because they want it both ways. They want to give him all the credit in the world for fighting real boxers now. But if you criticize it, it's like, well, hey, man, he's a beginner. Like, which one is it?
And I think that I look at him as a science project. And I wouldn't say I move the goalposts, but I at least respect the fact that, like, you got John the Influencer fighting Tom the Truck Driver, and Jake is, like, taking the sport serious enough where he can't just get away with that. So he's graduating, but I get what you're saying, where you're viewing him as a boxer. He's no longer one of these hybrids. You've dedicated yourself to the sport. You've got enough respect.
I'm giving him the full respect of making that transition, and
now he has to walk.
You're doing it, but now that comes with a whole different set of criticisms.
And if he doesn't want that, he has to say, "I'm not Jack. I'm not a straight up boxer." If you don't want that criticism, he has to come out. Okay, that I like that, you know, because I don't fully look at him as a full on boxer. I look at him as a businessman who sees a great opportunity in boxing, which he really enjoys. I don't view him as the same as Jaio Batalha.
I don't personally either, but he is now treating the sport with enough respect that it appears that there is at least a part of him that would actually like to get to that level. And so, and because he's no longer fighting Twitch streamers and retired wrestlers with hip replacements, he's fighting, for whatever the circumstances are, active pro boxers or inactive pro boxers. You did graduate. You know, we're not doing, you know, video game beefs anymore.
Yeah, you're not fighting Johnny the Twitch streamer. Did you see any? Let's go over the comments. Bipolar Boxing. I got to meet Floyd Diaz, Eddie Hearn, and Brace Mills last night. Mills has a very fun style to watch. That's great. Keep in contact with those guys as much as you can. Lionel Watson, how did you show up late to an on-site casino in Verona, New York? That's a great question, too.
Well, I could actually answer that question, Lionel. There's no fucking cell service up there. That's the only – if I'm doing benefit of the doubt, if you take one wrong turn up there, you're shit out of luck, fam.
So basically, you have to – GPS it and have some cliff notes.
Yeah, you gotta have a plan B unless you really know where you're going.
Okay, that's good. Any undercard fights that you saw? Did you see Jonathan Labumba Gonzalez win over Rene Santiago?
I didn't see any of it, but there is a guy from my neck of the woods, Elijah Flores, who I'm extremely excited about. I think he is a great talent, especially for like a 19-year-old guy. I think that's somebody to be on the lookout for. And I don't know if anybody else can hear it, but there is someone singing opera in the alleyway right now.
I could actually a little bit. And I was wondering, like, did you have someone over? Like, I was picturing someone, like, you had a girl over last night and she's smoking a cigarette on your sofa, like a avant-garde film, and just like kind of belting out.
No, that'd be great. I just basically live in a cartoon. So there is someone singing opera outside right now.
That's awesome. That's so good. my visual was so much cooler. Jonathan Labumba Gonzalez beats Rene Santiago. It was a close fight. Labumba has this weird habit of being in competitive, interesting fights, but I wouldn't necessarily say they're fun to watch. I was there live when he beat Soto in Fresno, and every round was close, competitive, and monotonous would be what I'd say. He has this habit of being a world champion that somehow, like, guys like Ken Shiro and Nata Shinga and Kiriel have dynamic traits, and he just lacks that dynamic trait, but he can win, and he can win rounds 60-40. This fight felt very much like that. I know a lot of people of the hardcore felt that Rene Santiago should have won the fight. Didn't seem like either objected. I don't know how much longer he can make this weight. It seems like he's a very big...
I don't know how any adult man could ever make that weight. Yeah.
I know I couldn't.
It's just crazy when that, and then they're like normal sized people. They're like, yeah, Junto Nakatani making 112. He's 5'8". I'm like, what are you talking about?
Yeah. Like, that's a different kind of dude. So that happened. And then I guess the most interesting thing was Javon Wana Walton. I'm not sure if you're aware of him, but he played Ashtray on Euphoria, HBO's Euphoria. I never saw that show, but I read about the show in the buildup to this. He was also a part of the Umbrella Academy, which I also have never seen, but he's basically a Hollywood actor who's having a lot of success, who also had an amateur career. He had like 50 amateur fights along with being an actor, but he actually did box in his growing up. And he fights to a draw with a very unassuming opponent, and he just looked green. He's a 17-year-old kid, and he just has a very, very amateur style, and it just MVP signed him. Pro, brother. Which one?
That's too young to go pro, in my opinion.
It's too young to go pro, and it looked as though, like, MVP has, like, a type of person they like to target, someone with a large social media footprint, someone that jumps into other media markets. They recently signed an Indian fighter who has a big following on social media that could probably get engagement in India. There's a direct correlation to they enjoy signing people that get the internet talking. He has a big footprint in the entertainment industry. He has a boxing background. But, I mean, this is someone that is going to really need to be moved with care. I saw someone that was less polished than Nico Ollie Walsh when Ollie Walsh first came out. And to be honest with you, I saw someone where I'm not really sure mentally he wants to go through the motions of being a fighter. He likes the idea of the pageantry and all that. But I think that there's too much.
Well, 17 years old. I didn't know what the fuck. I didn't know what I wanted at 17. I mean, shit.
But I think it's also like the opportunities in front of him. Like, you're doing a lot of these really great movies that mean a lot to people and TV shows that mean a lot. And then you have to get in there and fight guys who are looking at you as a way to change their life. Like, this guy, Joshua Torres, was 0-1-1, but really felt he could win this fight. And you probably expect to catch him with a big shot, knock him out, and all of a sudden you're living in hell in the third round. It looked like there was a level of, this isn't what I signed up for. And it wasn't as fun as I had expected. And I'm not sure how that matures over time. Like, I feel like this was more of him experimenting with the process. I'm sure he'll be back because he has that amateur pedigree. But I wouldn't be shocked if he does 3 or 4 fights and it kind of reminded me of when I saw the Chinese fighter with Golden Boy. Do you remember the Chinese wall or the wall, that heavyweight that was like 7 feet tall from China? And he was with Golden Boy when they used to do shows. And then just one day he was gone and he just never fought again. He just disappeared. He had like 6 or 7 fights. And I got a feeling of that from this guy. Was like, I could see him, like, us remembering he got signed and then us going, oh, I wonder what happened to him. But he was a big part of the buildup, was him. He was actually in commercials with Serrano and Paul, and he got a draw. And I think that that's kind of, I also heard a quote in the press conference that stuck out to me. He said, I'm going to move at my own pace. And that's not something I hear from fighters typically during media rounds. when fighters say, I'm going to move at my own pace and go at my own speed with my pro career.
Yeah.
How do you interpret that statement? Because to me, that was a very cautionary statement. When someone said that's laying the groundwork of saying, I'm going to take a lot of soft touches to start out my career is what
I'm going to take a lot of soft touches, or I have an abundance of time, which nobody does.
I mean, I don't hear, like, now this is a ridiculous statement, but I don't hear Keyshawn Davis saying, I'm going to move at my own pace. I don't hear Abdullah Mason saying that. And it's just like, maybe it's unfair that I compare the fighters to the best fighters in the world. But sadly, I've put a lot of time into boxing, and I want to be closer. Well, and
we pay $25 a month for the zone, right? We want a high-level product.
And also, I want to compare our great fighters. I want my standard of criticism to start with the modern greats and then hold you to that standard and then find where you fit, right? So I start with the greats and move down. And when I heard that statement from a fighter who was on his second fight, it was labeled a global debut. It's cautionary to me. It's absolutely cautionary, because I don't think Jamal Harvey, when he turns pro, is going to go, yeah, man, I'm going to move at my own speed. It just felt like a way of telling us where he sees himself without saying it.
Well, he's also a lot younger than all those guys.
Okay. Let's go into the final thing we're going to talk about this week. And that is, the fight, there's only one fight card, I believe. Or no, there's two fight cards. I guess we can jump into, well, we don't really. Do you have any interest in talking about Stephen Butler versus Steve Rolls? It's kind of an interesting Canada gatekeeper type fight, if we're going to be honest.
That's a good domestic show.
I mean, I'm going to definitely watch it. I'm probably going to be on coverage, but is it going to change the world? No. Is it going to possibly be a sneaky great fight? Maybe. Let's go into Anthony Joshua versus Francis Ngannou. I'm going to fill up my cup of coffee one more time. Why don't you just hate on this fight? Because I think the world needs some good Dakota just getting mad at kind of what boxing's doing right now.
Word. I unfortunately do have to wrap it up in a couple minutes. But when it comes to this fight, I actually don't hate it as much as you might think. Because at the end of the day, Tyson Fury legitimized Francis Ngannou, and Francis Ngannou legitimized himself. Is it the fight that I'm interested in seeing? No, but I think it's Anthony Joshua's ploy to find himself a fight with Tyson Fury, even though he was unable to beat Usyk. So should Fury defeat Usyk, I think he views this as a way to line himself up for that fight if he can embarrass Ngannou or make it a one-sided fight.
How important is this for both fighters' legacies?
I think legacy. It's a little tough to say Ngannou has a legacy with one fight, right? So I think the only legacy on the line is Joshua. And, of course, his is on the line here because, you know, as imperfect as he is, we still consider him one of the four or five best heavyweights in the world. And in theory, this should be a fight that he wins easily in much the same way that we thought Fury would win it easily. And I think that he will win it easily, actually, because I think that if Joshua has one thing that Fury doesn't have, it's discipline. I think he's a more disciplined guy. So I think we're going to get the same Joshua that we got against Otto Wallin that we get with Francis Ngannou. And Tyson Fury is not that consistent of a person.
If Ngannou drops Joshua, what are we looking at with Ngannou?
A real heavyweight. I mean, like a real guy in the mix. Honestly, it would mean that the Fury fight was less about Fury's lack of preparation than guys like you and I would have indicated.
Gail notes in the chat, Serrano said the injury took place after a chemical used during a hair salon visit 2 days before the fight got into her eye. It was described as an exposed cornea. Yeah. Okay. Just quick hits on this undercard for the absolute hardcore fight fan that wants to know. Big Bang Zhang is taking on Joseph Parker. For me personally, I just think that this is a terrible matchup for Joseph Parker. He's kind of struggled with these type of guys, the big punchers that are willing to punch. What do you see in this fight?
I'm sorry, who is he fighting?
Big Bang Zhang is taking on Joe Parker.
That's an amazing fight. That's an amazing fight, dude. That's one of the best fights you can make at heavyweight. It's like two guys that can't get the fights they deserve are going to fight each other. I love it. I didn't really know that was happening, I don't think.
So give me a breakdown, just real quick breakdown.
I mean, fuck, bro. They both have so much momentum behind them right now. It's honestly is the perfect time to make that fight, as much as I feel like Parker earned himself the Joshua rematch. That's really the part about the Ngannou fight that pisses me off, is less Ngannou and more so that Joe Parker beat Deontay Wilder. So it's, you know, that was initially whatever. You get what I'm saying, and so do the fans. I think that Parker is athletic and fluid enough to give Zhang problems. The question is, and is better defensively than Joe Joyce. The question is just, is Zhang able to affect Parker with his power in the same way that he's affected pretty much every other opponent? And is he going to get those opportunities? Because I think that Parker's probably the best athlete he's fought.
Okay, then we have the WBC featherweight world title between Nick Ball and the champion Ray Vargas. Any thoughts on that fight?
They're like the complete opposite. I kind of like the like super tall guy who boxes from the outside and like little meatball who's like a wrecking ball. I love that fight.
Yeah, that's what I think.
Name Vargas, but I love that matchup.
I think that like that really comes down to where Vargas is at, because these are the guys that Vargas used to pick apart back in the day. But if he's having any slippage, this could be the fight of the year, honestly, because if Ball gets on the inside, that's where you start getting a guy gets dropped. All of a sudden he's fighting back. Final one worth noting on this card is Israel Madrimayoff is taking on Magomed Korobanov. You might say, why are we talking about this fight other than they're really skilled? Jermell Charlo was stripped of the WBA junior middleweight title, so this fight will be for the vacant WBA middleweight title. This is an opportunity for Israel Madrimayoff, a guy that I was very high on. He turned pro, stopping Vladimir Hernandez in his first fight, which was a 10-round fight. There was enthusiasm that he was going to be moved very quickly, and then COVID hit, and his career really, really hit a stall. Is this the moment where he becomes a capital G guy in the division?
I think it's very possible. I mean, that's a great lineup of fights there. It's awesome because Joshua and Ngannou is the worst one.
So do you think, this is going to sound like a hater, does the card get gradually worse as you go up the bill, or does Parker Zhang redeem it?
Because that's a main event top. That's a real fight.
And Madrimayoff versus Korobanov to me is a real banger, and I think Ray Vargas and Nick Ball has a chance to be a heater. And then we have, for our UK fans,
the Madrimayoff fight, because people don't know either of those guys as much. But go watch either of them on YouTube, and your interest will go up.
Well, and I think there's also an American bias. If they can't say a guy's name easily, they don't care as much. So it's like, oh, who's this guy with the crazy name? If you're super nerdy, we got Justice Honey taking on Kevin Lorena, who's also a banger. So that's like a fun little local level fight. We got a good European fight with Gavin Gwynn and Mark Chamberlain. It's a good night of evenly contested fights. And I really hope Joshua can pull off this Ngannou win. Not that I cheer for anyone, because oh no, they said, is that fight canceled? Dan Raphael just said that Madrimayoff's fight is canceled. That would be the most on-brand thing if that's canceled. Well, that's unfortunate. I haven't seen that, but I'm sure if he said it, it's official. The most on-brand Joshua thing would be to have trouble with Ngannou. So I'm really hoping Joshua doesn't have issues with Ngannou, because that would be such an Anthony Joshua move.
Yeah.
Like, doesn't Joshua look good against the guys you think he's going to struggle with? And then when you expect him to have a spectacular performance,
there's some of that, but he's more, I know what I'm getting more with him than I do with Tyson Fury, even if it's more flawed.
I mean, to me, it's like Usyk and Joshua are probably the most professional people at heavyweight. Joshua's issue is he lacks the fluidity of Usyk. Yeah. So he just doesn't turn offense into defense, defense into offense. That shouldn't be as much of an issue with Ngannou, right?
I wouldn't think.
Is this fight good?
I really can't tell. I can't tell how much of the last one was just Fury not prepared. That's really what we're going to find out, right?
That's what it is. Dakota, where can people find you this week?
Well, as always, you can find me on the Lukey Dakota Show, whatever them boys over there, whatever you want to call it. I like that we let people call the show what they want to call it. Follow me on YouTube, Instagram, at the Slip and Weave Podcast. Check me out on ITR Boxing. I'm out here.
Okay, sounds good. See you next week.